How did an argument in Khartoum between rival generals drag Sudan into civil war and push it back to the brink of a repeat of the Darfur genocide of two decades ago? Hasn't happened yet, but the stage is perhaps set in El Fasher, the West's only city still in the hands of junta leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. It's besieged by the rapid support forces of Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, a.k.a. Hamdeti, his RSF, the offshoot of the Arab Janjaweed militias that two decades ago slaughtered upwards of 200,000 Masalit, Fur, and Zaghawa civilians. After 2005, there were mea culpas, pledges to never again allow a repeat of the 21st century's first genocide. Fast forward to 2024, and the international community has a chance to do that, yet its gaze right now is elsewhere, what with what's going on in the Middle East, in Ukraine. What to do to get attention on Sudan, on Darfur, and why, after a year of fighting, is there no end in sight for the people of Sudan? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking about a Darfur that's once again on the brink. Joining us is Sudanese activist Jafar Mohamud. Mohamud Sainin, thanks for being with us again. You have family in El Fasher, you were saying?
Yes. Right, thank you for having me.
We'll talk about that in a moment. Pleased to welcome Holud Hayir, founding director of Risk Consultants Confluence Advisory, normally on the wrong side of the English Channel, but today you're with us. Thanks for being with us. Shaheen El Sharif, co-founder and director of the YA Sudan Advocacy Group, YA or YA, how do you say it?
Youth in Action Sudan.
Youth in Action Sudan. Thanks for joining
Thank
us.
You.
Marc Lavagne is Research Director Emeritus at France's National Scientific Research Center, the CNRS. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. Before we go to our panel, let's first cross to Claire Nicolet, Program Director for Doctors Without Borders, MSF's Sudan operations. Thank you for speaking with us here on the France 24 debate. You provide for a swelling number of internally displaced around the city of El Fasher, most notably at the Zamzam refugee camp that's on the outskirts of the capital of North Darfur. What's the latest you can tell us?
Well, the situation is getting harder and harder because already the response is very poor compared to the needs. So it's the reality in Zamzam camp, it's the reality in North Darfur in general, in Darfur in general, and in Sudan even. So we were already very worried of the situation. And now what we are hearing is, of course, more fighting is already happening. So for 2 weeks now, we have lots of fighting around El Fasher, more airstrikes, more fighting. We receive already lots of patient wounded the past 2 weeks. So 125 wounded we received in the hospital. And now we are seeing that the nutrition situation is completely dramatic already. And with this situation, we don't even know how we'll be able to continue to cover the needs and to scale up, because there is a need of scale up of the humanitarian response now.
And in the past year, with civilians fleeing the surrounding countrysides, the population of the city has swelled.
Yes, exactly. So we've seen a lot of people coming from the south, but now the north and the east as well. So Zamzam camp has been really expanding. El Fasher also, there are lots of gathering sites of lots of displaced all over the Darfur. They came to El Fasher and North Darfur in general. So obviously the needs are even higher, and more the people are displaced, the more vulnerable they are as well, because they are coming with nothing. And when they're coming there is no food, there is no health, proper health care, even though we are trying our best, it's not enough. Water is a problem, so basically we see more and more vulnerable population there.
One last question for you, Claire Nicolet. We're showing there on the screen a map. How are you getting your aid in? Is it coming in through Port Sudan on the or is it coming through neighboring Chad?
So we are bringing everything from Chad, because the road from Port Sudan is not feasible in the past month. So everything is coming from Chad. And obviously with the current security situation, it's even harder. Rainy season is coming, so it will be very difficult to deliver as much as we can. And food, of course, is one of the main concerns at the moment.
I want to thank you so much for being with us for that update. Claire Nicolet of MSF. Now, you heard the humanitarian situation spelled out there by that humanitarian aid agency. On Monday, the United States ambassador to the UN issued this stark warning about the threat of a catastrophe in El Fasher.
The RSF is planning an imminent attack on El Fasher. As I've said before, history is repeating itself in Darfur in the worst possible way. And an attack on El Fasher would be a disaster on top of a disaster. It would put 500,000 internally displaced persons at risk, people who traveled from across Darfur to seek refuge.
Now, on Tuesday, the Sudan Tribune reported that army warplanes had launched airstrikes on Rapid Support Forces, the RSF positions, within the confines of the city of El Fasher. Jafar Mohamedou Sain, what are your relatives, what are your friends telling you from there?
Well, from what we're hearing from the families and the relatives, the people who are caught up in this dilemma, the situation is getting very worried. Situation is becoming beyond disaster. The city has been besieged since late October to this day. Nothing is getting out, nothing is coming out. Even those who are bringing humanitarian aid, like medical supplies from the places like Chad, has been deliberately prevented by the Rapid Support Forces. Donc, they weaponized this besiege to make Al Fasher people, the people of Al Fasher, to surrender. The Fasher is not the city of the inhabitant of Al Fasher. Fasher, entire Darfur, after fall of Niala, Zalinje, Jenina, entire Darfur fled to Al Fasher to get protected from the looting and killing and raping of Rapid Support Forces. Now, for the meantime, in the last 2-3 weeks, the situation has become very aggravated. This because this Rapid Support Forces and their militia, they constantly start bombarding and shelling the neighborhood of Al Fasher, the outskirts, the neighborhood, for no any apparent reason. They're just trying to make Al-Fashir people to surrender. And the situation is what we are facing. It's total catastrophe. And this will lead to potential all-out war. And we don't know the consequence of that would be. But their attention now...
Is peaceful surrender an option?
Peaceful surrender, that would be... That's not going to be the option, because the Fashir, those who were... sought help in Al Fasher, those who were forced from their homes in places like Niala, like Zalinje, like places of the other towns were falled, so where do you have to run? They have no solution. And those forces who are now protecting these civilians, made of SAF, made up of joint forces, made up of...
Sudan's armed forces.
Yes, yeah, Sudan armed forces, protection forces, which made of the former rebel group who signed Juba Peace Signature. So those forces, they are obliged to defend their people, because what is happening, it is just targeting people on the base of their ethnicity. This is war, have nothing to do with the so-called democracy. This has nothing to do, because the SAF, if the problem with the SAF, and the SAF, it is the garrison of the SAF, it is stuck in the middle of the town of, you are talking about 2 million population. So, and instead, they have been warned. They have been warned many times. Fasher is the only city that left in Al Darfur. It's the only humanitarian hub. Fasher should be left, but the aggression action that been taken by this aggressor, which were financed and supported by the international region forces, their aim is to inflict another episode of the worst genocide we may about to witness in Al-Fashir, because this city is not going to be surrendered regardless of what is going to happen. So the situation is very worrying. And instead of the international community, those, you know, international stakeholders, instead of sending very strong message, strong punitive message to these militias and to their international backers, because tomorrow...
We're going to talk about the international backers in a moment. Well, a lot to unpack there. Khalid Hayir, 13 months on, what started again as an argument between in the high halls of power, is it, as you just heard it described now, the potential for an ethnic war, or even some are even talking about Sudan becoming another Libya, with each group having their turf, basically?
I think what Jaffa described, that this is very much ethnically motivated, is what we've seen throughout this past 13 months. In many ways, we're seeing a continuation of the genocide that took place 20 years ago in 2003 to 2005. But what we have in Al-Fashir, which makes it all the more dangerous, is we have the confluence of genocide and famine. And MSF has been the only organization really brave enough to say that word, famine. And recent studies have shown that what is happening in West Darfur and now also in different parts around Al-Fashir also constitutes genocide. Both of these words, genocide and famine, are words the international community doesn't want to say. Mm. So all of the words we're hearing, all the statements that we're hearing from multiple countries, multiple organizations, the UN, Saudi, the US, even the United Arab Emirates, these are all just words because they're not being backed up by action. If we cannot define what is happening, we cannot really solicit the right kind of action.
And just explain this to us, because so you had the fall of Omar al-Bashir, you had a revolution. You had, I guess you could call it a counter-revolution, what with coups and takeover by the military, pushing aside the civilian leadership. Why is this turning into a revival of a genocide that was in the past?
Well, because that genocide was never resolved. There was never any kind of recompense or addressing of the injustices of that time. And this was very much fueled by that impunity. The generals have learned that they can stage coups, they can stage genocides, and effectively the world will not take them to task. And this is very much is the consequence, direct consequence, of them getting away with effectively murder. So what we're seeing now is, yes, this is very much presenting as a catastrophe, but we must put this in the broader context of this is a counter-revolutionary war. This war is partly waged on the citizens of Sudan to try to minimize...
Why didn't it stay in Khartoum, is my question.
It started in Khartoum, if we remember, and it very quickly spread to other parts of the country because at the local level, there are political logics at play that are locally motivated, very much driven by the settling of scores at the local level that also happen to use the war at the national level as a good cover. So what we're seeing is most of these genocidal attacks are actually between communities in this area, driven by and motivated by the politics at the national level.
Okay, so we heard at the outset the strong words of the United States ambassador to the UN, warning of a potential for a disaster within a disaster. At the other end of the spectrum, the RSF's Twitter feed, awash with propaganda images of jubilant soldiers communing with the local population in Darfur. I guess, Shaheen El-Sharif, I'll begin with a question for you about the messaging, the way all of this is being explained to the international community.
Well, since the onset of the war, media has been the first weapon used in the war. Different propaganda, especially by the RSF, it's become something that the Sudanese community is used to the point where the media...
Is it effective?
Well, it's effective in desensitizing a lot of the people reading, people keeping up with the Sudan war. It's a flood of misinformation that is really not targeted at sending quite a message, but at losing the actual message in the middle of all the noise. And that has been consistently happening and being utilized by the RSF. What has happened in Jenina months ago is exactly what the people currently entrapped in Al-Fashir are worried about. The question of peaceful surrender that you put forth, that is almost a situation that happened in Jazeera that the people of Fashir now fear. So there are no options being presented by the conflicting parties here And as such, we need the international community to move on the request of the people who are about to be murdered.
Do you agree with Khalid again about why it sort of graduated from a power struggle at the top into this potential for another ethnic conflict?
I completely agree with Khalid, and I would add another level is that the parties here are well aware of these different layers of the conflict. They're specifically using and motivating these lower levels of conflicts happening. They're recruiting people based on previous conflicts between tribes. They're instigating hate amongst the different regions in Sudan. And this is not just the RSF. It might have started there, but now even the SAF is using that.
All right. And then, of course, there's the spillover, food insecurity hitting Sudanese refugees over the border in Chad. We can show you images that were filmed last week by Belgian television in Adre. That's just over the border from El Janina in West Darfur.
For the month of April, we have to reduce the rationing because the WFP doesn't have enough money. This rationing is for 20 people. We give them oil, cereal, beans, and salt.
Thank God we arrived safely and we're now looking for food. We don't have jobs and we can't buy anything. This is all we have to survive.
So it's pretty shocking in a way, Marc Lavan, because in that case, they don't even have to cross over through a war zone. It's just feeding refugees that are inside of Chad, and yet they don't have enough to feed them there. Why is there so little help?
Well, this is really a mystery, definitely, because Chad is a place where arms are coming, weapons to feed the war in Darfur. And food can easily arrive. I mean, the French army is there, close to the border. There are planes and all the facilities that could help to support the population over there. And the humanitarian bodies like MSF, they are there. They are working there as much as they can. But I'm very surprised that nobody crosses the border in order to stop the genocide itself among especially the community of the Masalit within Western Darfur and in other places, I mean, in Darfur, all along the border. I mean, the border is just on paper. I mean, it doesn't exist really. And if the international community would like to cross and to solve the problem on the ground, it could be easily done. I was in Darfur first in 1985. There was already a food crisis there at the time. And I came several times later in the 2000s when another crisis erupted. So I know all these places and they are easily available. Reachable by any place from Chad, of course, not from inner Sudan. And I would assume, I mean, there are so many crises recurring in Darfur since those 40 years that the problem which should be settled is the gap between the Nile Valley and all surrounding provinces in Sudan. I mean, Sudan used to be the largest country in Africa. So there is this development gap, which is political, economical, human gap. And this is the root cause of the problems, which is not targeted at all at the moment. I mean, we are trying to find a humanitarian solution, but there is no humanitarian solution. I mean, of course, you can give some help in the people who are inside.
Well, right now, there's an emergency, which is feeding the people who are going hungry, as you say, the risk of a famine.
I mean, I went there several times in humanitarian actions with MSF or others back, as I said, 40 years ago and all along. So nothing is solved, and the problem remains. Not only, and there was a political democratic transition in Sudan, which was not supported by the Western countries, by nobody. So it failed, and the armies are fighting not to take over the state, but just to take over, to take the wealth of Sudan.
How could they have supported more the revolution in Khartoum? How could they have done it?
Well, this is a matter for politicians. This is a matter for diplomats.
You're saying the West didn't support it enough.
No. They didn't take the problem, tackle the problem on the ground.
They what didn't could they tackle have done?
In earnest, the problem. I mean, this problem of gap in economic...
propose a Marshall Plan, you're saying?
Something like that. Yeah,
so definitely. Just one last question. On Monday, there's a presidential election in Chad. And Mahamat Idriss Déby's father, he was no stranger to border tensions when the genocide was going on 2 decades ago. What happens after voting day? How does he, the Chad strongman, view what's going on over the border then?
Well, he's strong, but with some limits. I mean, he has a ground. He is himself from a place which is at the border with Darfur, Tine. Which is split in two, one in Darfur, one in Chad. And his family, which is a kind of a royal family over there, knows very well, and part of the family has a Chad-Sudanese passport, some others have a Chadian passport. So definitely he could have a say in what happens in Darfur, because this is a threat. Darfur was the source of many threats. In Chad, I was in N'Djamena with the ministers and then the government when the attackers came from Darfur at the time. That was in 2006 or so.
Now, up to now, Mahamat Idriss Déby has been trying to walk a tightrope, trying to keep channels open with both sides in Sudan. How's he doing?
Before I come to the point to answer this concerning the neighboring Chad, I just want to go back to the point that mentioned by Khalud when she said this war, it is a counter-democracy war that had led to the localized level. This is the false narrative or false diagnosis and denial that has led to the things to reach to this level. Now,
how so?
How so? I can tell you, because this war was ignited because of the so-called the framework agreement that the FFC wished to impose on the other side. The other side has refused, and then they resorted to the military option. That military option was led by this former Janjaweed leader. And when their plan of coup d'etat by force has failed, and now the consequence has led to this now catastrophic war. The people of Sudan, until to this day, nobody was forced or manipulated by other party to take an arm. Because we have seen genocide in El Geneina. We have seen the mass killing and rape in places like Medani. All of this, ethnic people were targeted based on their ethnicity. Either they accept this false narrative or either they will be banished. Now, I'll come to
Here on this point before we go back to Chad. Go ahead. You agree with that?
Well, I think, let me clarify my point. My point was there is a counter-revolutionary war happening at the national level, regardless of what was happening in terms of the disagreement between the generals. That is separate. The point is that they are both fighting a war against the Sudanese people. We have seen that in the targeting, give me a second, of the way that they have targeted pro-democracy forces.
This is where...
This is where you and I are
totally disagreeing
one second. Jafar, please. Okay. You'll have your chance. Go ahead.
No problem. I think the issue is that we are seeing the targeting of doctors, journalists, people who have created professional organizations that have a mandate. Neither of the generals do. We have seen the targeting of resistance committees, emergency response rooms, and pro-democracy actors, lawyers, etc. That is not by accident. It is not just part of this. What I was saying is that there are different political logics that are at play at the local level and at the national level, and this war has allowed for those to come together. I'm not saying that one exists necessarily outside of the other one. Both of these things can be true. Certainly what we're seeing on the ground level is that these ethnic tensions are playing out in genocidal acts committed by the RSF.
But who?
But this is a very large country with very differing political dynamics at play.
But who started this ethnic dimension? Let me come back to the definition of this, what you describe revolution. Revolution that has managed to push al-Bashir, I and many thousands, hundreds of thousands of Sudanese has contributed in bringing that revolution. And that revolution has been derailed from the 11th of April of 2019. Yes, let's make it clear on that one. And the second point, the ethnic dimension.
So long before the latest military
coup. Yeah. Long before the revolution was
just
derailed.
Just making clear for our viewers. Go ahead. Yeah.
And the revolution was divided. One side, the majority, they're saying that this revolution is derailed because this revolution derailed under the bless of FFC, the one who recognized this junta leader, the one who recognized this the Himeti, and then they went on to sign, and then we arrived to this point. Now, coming to the point of Chad. Chad is, you know, caught up in a very predictive situation. Chad is caught up in a time where they themselves were facing a lot of challenges. And this, the backer of this malicious rebel support forces, UAE, has managed to trap Chad so that the Chad territory should be used to transfer all the military equipment to just aggravate it. To just aggravate this war. This is not my word. This is the there are many reports that been, you know, in New York Times, in Wall Street journalists, the involvement of UAE through Chadian borders.
Yeah.
So Chad, after the election, you know, the future of the regime of Mohamed Idriss Deby depending on the outcomes of war in Sudan. The outcome of war in Sudan, it is depending on how long this militia who's now just is going, you know, crazy on civilian population, how long will last, you know, will it stand? Depend on that one. So
how intertwined, Shaheen El-Sharif, are the fates of Sudan and Chad right now? Again, we're at the eve of this election that's taking place on Monday.
Well, Sudan, since the start of the conflict, was surrounded by multiple countries on years of elections, and elections are always tumultuous times for any country. For Chad, I do agree. For South Sudan, a lot of pressure has been put on the leaders of these countries through their difficult election times. And I couldn't tell you more about what exactly is happening, as we're having multiple reports. Everything is still being investigated. I am certain that a lot of these countries will have a different response following their elections, as the spillover is much greater than what any financial benefit can come to their country.
Yeah, and that's part of it, because, again, the lines are a bit blurred, if you will, between who's supposed to be supporting who. We've had mediation from the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. We have, as you heard Jafir saying, these documented links between the United Arab Emirates and the RSF, particularly when it pertains to things like gold mines. But those traditional political fault lines getting scrambled with, for instance, Russia's Wagner militias have also been backing Hemeti. But here you see Russia's foreign ministry's top diplomat for the region. He was welcomed at the start of the week to Port Sudan by the junta, not by the RSF. Strongman Abdel Fattah al-Burhan's a longtime ally of his Egyptian namesake, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Here you see the pair together on February 29th of this year. But al-Burhan's not picky when it comes to weapons shopping. He's bought drones from Tehran, as reported last week in Africa Confidential. They've been operating since January from an airbase north of Khartoum. So the Iranians are supplying General al-Burhan against the RSF, which is aligned with Iran's ally these days, Russia. We don't understand.
It's just...
Now, if I may say, it's actually, you know, the regular business on the world stage. everyone is pursuing their interest. When we're seeing Iran's interest in Sudan, regardless of the reports, Iran is looking for another entrance to the Red Sea after UAE's big bid in the area.
So it's more about than just making money and selling drones?
It's much more. This is more about spreading influence in Africa. We have seen Tehran's ministers in Africa this year. They're trying to make new friends. Sudan has been open for an open proxy war, if you may, for many countries right now. And the Red Sea is currently the hottest spot in the world, and Sudan is right there.
I think
let me just ask Marc Levin on this. What's the most significant in all this? The UAE's role, Russia's role, Iran's role?
Well, everyone is trying to play his own interests in a very opportunistic way. And I agree that Iran is seizing an opportunity. There is no ideology behind that. I mean, as elsewhere in Africa, it's the chance to gain a port, for instance, even for Russia, on the Red Sea, facilities everywhere, and also to get access to the wealth of Sudan, which is mainly gold, mineral resources, and also the food in order of food security investments. I mean, there are a lot of countries that are involved in the Sudanese economy in order to grasp the wealth of the country, so, along the Nile, as well as in the countries, in the provinces surrounding the Nile Valley.
Khalid Hayir, it makes it sound like mission impossible for the international community to put aside those business interests and try to actually save lives.
Well, the reality is that the war economy has taken root very quickly in Sudan, and international actors are seizing the moment to get Sudanese assets, whether that's minerals, uranium, gold, access to the Red Sea, for fire sale prices. And this is absolutely part of the calculation of many of these different actors to get involved in this war. And you're right, that means it's going to be infinitely harder to reconcile all of these different and often competing interests to get towards a resolution. But this will be compounded even more if the war continues and we see the fragmentation, particularly of the RSF, into not just one group, but several groups, and potentially those different militias and entities supporting the SAF also break away. That would make
Why would there be this fragmentation?
We're already seeing signs of this. So we're already seeing warlordism take place within areas controlled by the RSF. We're seeing some signs of breakaway from the top commanders of the RSF, particularly those away from the Darfur base. And they're recruiting on behalf of themselves, not on behalf of the RSF. And the RSF in many ways runs as a transnational criminal organization, like a franchise. And the reality is that the fragmentation of that is going to make it much, much more difficult to achieve some kind of resolution.
So on that score, Marc Levin, this U.S.-Saudi bid at mediation, are they the right people to try to mediate? Who should be doing it? And how come the Emiratis don't listen to the Saudis?
To me, there is a top-down approach by those big powers, which doesn't fit the reality on the ground, because the actors are very independent from each other, as was just said. I mean, there are a lot of new groups that are emerging on an ethnic basis, which is something very also regrettable, because it was not the case at the start. I mean, it was basically the Sudan is part of the Sahel, and it faces the same threat as the Sahel, that is desertification, climate change, and these are the nomads that have no more herds. They can't survive else out of taking the land from the farmers. This is the base. And then it splits into local rifts and wars among different tribes and people.
Jafar Mohamed Sainin, is your family witnessing this fragmentation that's being described, this warlordism?
It is likely. At this point, I can agree with Khalid, because the longer it takes this war, the more it became difficult to manage it, because the rapid support forces, it has reached to the point of no return. Either the other part or the state, which represented by the SAF and the vast majority of Sudanese, accept to find a piecemeal solution for them, or either they will just go and just destroy whatever that they found. So the likely scenario of more warlordism and the entire region became the hub for, you know, the terrorists, for, you know, the trafficking of, you know, the drugs and all that is really likely. This is one thing. And the second thing, what has, I come back to the point of SAF leaning toward Iran. I think this is a result of what I call a complicity of the international stakeholder, like the power, great forces like Britain, like the USE and the Western camp. Instead this diagnosing what happening in Sudan through their lens, they start, you know, diagnosing the thing through the lens of Emiratis, who have really a project of, you know, like getting rid of the ancient Sudan to replace with their men. And then from there, they can, you know, continue to achieve their objective. So the international community, the big forces, this is where they, you know, were hesitant until, you know, this SAF and the other camp, they were pushed to go toward Iran. And most likely, they were not going to stop there. They will even go to approach the Russian, the counter-Western camp. It's really likely. So either the international community.
Do you see that happening, Shaheen El-Sharif? I mean, again, it's Egypt is the natural ally of General al-Burhan, especially this Egyptian leader.
Well, Egypt is going through a rough time of its own. As I said earlier, a lot of countries surrounding us in this particular moment are going through their own rough patches. So it's quite difficult to see anyone putting weight behind any ally of his inside Sudan. It's more about regional influencers that is more problematic.
Because our viewers are confused. Again, seeing the Egyptians and the Iranians supporting the same side in this.
Yes, again, with Egypt, again, as I said, this was a place of interest now. Egypt's strategic alliance with the SAF has been there for at least 100 years. This is not an ally that could be replaced at all, but there is still some hesitance in the way they're behaving, as we're seeing.
And for you, who's the natural mediator for this conflict?
Currently,
who would be the best one?
Sudanese people.
Of course, that's going to be the Sudanese people, but I would have to add that at this point, the international community could play a very big role in mediation if they put their weight on this. Sudan currently is more of a geopolitical interest war of political interest rather than any national threats or national security to anyone. This is a place where the international community could come together and
But who? Make the international community is vague.
We're talking about the West mostly. They have much power and no moves to be put in Sudan. They have played the role of humanitarian aid, which they also haven't done enough in for the international community. If they're trying to put their weight on humanitarian aid, it's very weak. So again, this is quite disappointing from the international stage.
Khalid Hayer, do you agree?
I think
the West should step up and play mediator role?
I think the West should step up. It's made several commitments and it should honor them. We have seen the West, frankly, flounder when it comes to upholding international humanitarian law in other contexts. So it's not a surprise that we're not seeing, for example, calls for preventing loss of life and atrocities and a genocide determination, because that has ramifications for the West doing so elsewhere, namely Gaza. But I think what Shaheen is trying to get at is that there is a leadership role here to be played. To my mind, it requires a broader range of actors. It cannot just be the West. The West has lost a lot of traction in this part of the world. We have seen other actors closer to home, particularly in the Arab region, gain a lot more momentum, a lot more power, a lot more influence over actors in Sudan. And it's the sort of bringing together of those two arenas that could produce a united front against this war. We haven't seen that heavy lift diplomacy yet, particularly from Western actors who say that they're interested in restoring Sudan to democracy, or at least towards a transition, and the Arab neighbors in the region who are very invested but are not invested in democracy. There needs to be heavy lift diplomacy between those two to get at least a consensus that the war must end. We don't have that consensus yet, which means we can't get the leverage in place to force that these two actors and the others that support them to put down their weapons. Until we do that, there's no point jumping straight into a mediation. And we now have, what, five or six different mediation platforms, all of which are failing because they're not getting the consensus to end the war. They're not putting the leverage and incentive structures in place to be able to put that towards a mediation.
Mm. You see the problem, Francois, the problem of this war, resolving is not going to be that difficult. But, you know, this to resolve this war, unless the things be diagnosed as it is, you see, and instead of, you know, this language of, you know, bringing, you know, the conflicting parties. There is no two parties. There is one party, which is a state, either we like it or not, led by de facto ruler Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. There is a militia, that who have no support at all. You see, today, after this war, over 80% of the Sudanese people, they said they are standing behind the army.
Again, the outside, it's seen as an argument between two men in uniform.
No, too many. This is the wrong description that has been propagated through the international media. But reality on the ground is totally another different story.
Let's listen in that case to a man who didn't wear a uniform. When he came to Paris for a Sudan donor conference earlier this month, the ousted former civilian prime minister, Abdallah Hamdok, sat down with France 24's Mark Perlman.
General Hemeti, we met with him. He agreed with us that we need to go through a political process. We are yet to hear the same sentiments echoed by Burhan.
So let me put it to you, Shaheen Al-Sharif. Can you negotiate with either of these gentlemen to have a transition to the democracy to which Khalid Hayer aspires?
I think that's too early. Currently, our main concern is lives. That is the main concern. We can't be jumping and talking about democratic transition and all of that if people are still dying. We need to address that first.
Marc Lavergne.
Well, I see, the good thing is that there is no civil war in Sudan. This is a competition between two groups that want to plunder the country. They have no project for state building or any kind of the sort. So this should make things easier for the international community to intervene. But I think the opportunity has been missed. And now things are loose. I mean, there are so many actors that are emerging on the ground in Darfur especially that I don't know how the international community could efficiently intervene. They have shown no interest in the Sudan plight up to now, and even this in the international conference on humanitarian aid is the proof that there is no political support for the peace in Sudan. I mean, people are just trying to get
a final word on this. Khalid Hayer is, in other words, what Shaheen was describing. The first step is ensuring the humanitarian aid gets in. Is that the first step? Is that
absolutely the first step? Because the reports are showing that millions of people are at risk of dying of famine this year. What the point about democracy is that is generally where a lot of people want to go. But we cannot lose sight of what the current priorities are. That is safeguarding human life, civilian protection, and ensuring that people have enough to eat, not just now, but in the near future. That means also safeguarding the next agricultural season and not just bringing trucks of food where we can as soon as possible. That kind of holistic thinking is absolutely missing from the international community and the aid industry at the moment, and it requires being put front and center. And all sides need to be put in front of this, not just aid actors, but also local domestic groups.
Khalid Hayer, I want to thank you so much. I want to thank as well for being with us, Jafar Mohamed Sain, Shaheen Al-Sharif, Marc Lavergne. Thank you for joining us here. There's more on our website, France24.com.